Even after Yahya Sinwar's death, the fighting rages on.
Whether Sinwar is gone or not, you know, it doesn't change the fact that on the ground right now, you're going to have some kind of guerrilla resistance to the Israelis.
The U.S. Secretary of Defense is in Ukraine.
The visit comes days after President Zelensky made public the details of the Ukrainian victory plan, saying it aims to strengthen the Ukrainian position to end the war with the help of its allies.
And Russian election interference. It's not just an American problem.
Their target of buying 300,000 votes documented by state institutions and paying 150,000 people to vote shows we must look closely at where mistakes were made.
Today is Tuesday, October 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has left for the Middle East. The State Department said Washington is pushing to kickstart ceasefire negotiations and end the Gaza war following the death of Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar.
In Israel, the secretary will reaffirm the United States' ironclad commitment to Israel's security and emphasize advancing enduring peace and security for Israelis and Palestinians alike.
That's Vedant Patel, the State Department's deputy spokesperson.
Throughout the region, Secretary Blinken will discuss the importance of bringing the war in Gaza to an end, securing the release of all hostages and alleviating the suffering of the Palestinian people. He will continue discussions with counterparts on post-conflict period planning and emphasize the need to chart a new path forward that enables Palestinians to rebuild their lives and realize their aspirations free from Hamas's tyranny.
Along with an end to the hostilities and the return of hostages still held captive in Gaza, Blinken will stress the importance of humanitarian relief for the Palestinian people.
The secretary will also underscore that additional food, medicine, and other urgently needed humanitarian aid must be delivered to civilians in Gaza. He will also discuss the need to reach a diplomatic resolution in the conflict between Israel and Hezbollah that fully implements UN Security Council Resolution 1701 and allows civilians on both sides of the blue line to return to their homes. And lastly, he will reaffirm the U.S. commitment to work with partners across the region to de-escalate tensions and providing lasting stability.
It's Blinken's 11th trip to the region since the October 7th, 2023 attack on Israel by Hamas that triggered the war. It comes as Israel has intensified its military campaign in Gaza and in Lebanon against Hezbollah. Just last week, however, there was optimism that a turning point had been reached and a peace deal was close at hand. Israel had announced that Yahya Sinwar, the head of Hamas and architect of the October 7th attacks, had been killed in a firefight in Gaza. World leaders, including Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, expressed optimism that it was an opportunity for negotiations. However, Blinken's trip aside, there seems to be little appetite for a ceasefire among the groups actually fighting each other. For some context on all this, I'm joined by Ishan Tharoor of The Washington Post.
It's not clear combatants on either side are ready for that deal. Specifically, it's not clear that the government of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu are interested in a deal right now. They are, as we're seeing, pressing war on multiple fronts. They're pounding targets in Lebanon and have carried out elements of a ground invasion there. They're really squeezing Gaza right now, especially northern Gaza, pounding areas in northern Gaza, choking off aid, critical aid, to hundreds of thousands still there. And this is all, you know, in the hopes of, you know, applying further pressure on what they see as a kind of military target.
A lot of people in Israel are showing that Sinwar's death is proof that a strong military response works.
Well, that's certainly the logic of some people. You heard some of Netanyahu's far-right allies specifically say that, look, terrorism can be defeated militarily. You have analysts and media pointing to the way in which Sri Lanka stamped out the Tamil Tigers a decade and a half ago as an example of successfully just crushing a militant enemy. But it's most people who study the region, most people who study insurgencies, most people who understand the nature of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict don't feel that that's applicable in this context.
Now, let's be fair. Sinwar wasn't universally loved by Palestinians either. He was called the Butcher of Khan Yunis for a reason. He was brutal, even to his own people. Is there some sense among Palestinians that his death will allow for a new beginning and perhaps peace?
Indeed, Sinwar has a lot of blood on his hands, the blood of Israelis, the blood of foreign nationals killed by Hamas attacks, and the blood of Palestinians, including many in Gaza, who were killed by Sinwar and his associates for alleged collaboration with the Israelis. So there are many who will not shed a tear for his loss, and there are many Gazans who have spoken to media really lamenting what has happened to their lives and what has happened to their homes as a result of the specific conflict that Sinwar triggered through the October 7th attack. At the same time, we're now in a situation where Gaza has been so pulverized and ravaged, where so many countless Palestinians have experienced loss, trauma, sadness, grief. There's so many, the tens of thousands of new orphans in Palestine. There's a whole generation of children who are not in school, who have seen their brothers and sisters killed. That you're seeing a whole population that will take a very long time to recover from this if they can. And whether Sinwar is gone or not, you know, it doesn't change the fact that on the ground right now, you're going to have some kind of guerrilla resistance to the Israelis. And it's almost a certainty that a new generation of quote-unquote resistance will emerge in the years to come.
When Sinwar was killed, and we heard from Joe Biden, we heard from Kamala Harris, we heard from Olaf Scholz, we heard from the EU that this is a new chapter, this is a beginning, this is a way for peace talks to begin. Were all those people misguided, misinformed? I mean, they clearly have to have access to the same information that you do.
I mean, you can say that perhaps they're engaging in a degree of wishful thinking. I think it is quite clear that officials in the U.S. in the Biden administration, many of their European counterparts, would like to see this conflict draw down, would like to see a ceasefire, would like to see hostilities end, but have not been willing to exert the kind of leverage and pressure specifically on the Israeli government that it needs to be leveraged in order to actually force a deal. And so they were hoping that this is a moment. Look, this is a great symbolic moment. Sinwar is dead. Time magazine put a big red X on his face. Here we are. This is the time to turn the page. But that's clearly not top of mind for Prime Minister Netanyahu. You had a major far-right rally that's taking place early this week on the borders of Gaza, where members of Netanyahu's Likud party, as well as other far-right parties, are all calling for the complete emptying and resettlement of Gaza. So, and that's a vision that absolutely does not fit into the stated goals and policy ambitions of the West. So there is a degree to which Western leaders throughout the course of this conflict have been engaging Israel, but not really engaging the reality of Israel's far-right government.
Ishan Tharoor writes for The Washington Post. Mr. Tharoor, thanks so much for your time. Thanks for your analysis today.
Thanks for having me.
U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin visits Ukraine amid continued Russian gains on the front line and uncertainty within Ukrainian society regarding the future of U.S. aid after the upcoming presidential election. Our correspondent in Kyiv, Anna Chernakova, has the story.
U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin arrived in Ukraine on a previously unannounced visit Monday. This is his fourth visit to Ukraine and comes just 2 weeks before the U.S. presidential elections. The Pentagon chief was meeting with Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky and Defense Minister Rustem Umerov to discuss Ukraine needs on the battlefield and U.S. efforts to support the Ukrainian defense forces in the year ahead. The visit comes days after President Zelensky made public the details of the Ukrainian victory plan, saying it aims to strengthen the Ukrainian position to end the war with the help of its allies.
Це план посилення нашої держави, посилення.
He said Ukraine's victory plan is a plan to strengthen our country, to strengthen our positions, so that the country is strong enough to end the war, so that Ukraine has all the muscles. Zelensky said this plan can be implemented. It depends on our partners. I emphasize on partners. It certainly does not depend on Russia. Austin's visit to Kyiv is been seen as a sign of support for Ukraine's continued struggle against Russia's full-scale aggression, which is approaching a three-year mark. The U.S. Defense Secretary's trip comes as Ukraine goes through a deterioration on the battlefield and growing anxiety within the Ukrainian society of the Western allies' fatigue towards the Russia-Ukraine war. Political analyst Mykola Bielyskov says Ukrainians are afraid to be forced into a short-term peace deal instead of an agreement that will ensure Russia will not come back with a more powerful assault in the upcoming years. He said wars of attrition are a very difficult thing in terms of maintaining focus and willingness to invest further. This is a real challenge for Ukraine. This is what the Russian Federation is counting on in its strategy. Ukrainians don't want the scenario of the Minsk agreements to be repeated, which failed to end the war in the Donbas area in 2014-2015 and gave time to Russia to prepare for the full-scale invasion in 2022. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
Meanwhile, local authorities in eastern Ukraine report that Russian forces attacked Kryvyi Rih with rockets before dawn on Monday. A total of 9 people were injured during the attacks, including a 12-year-old girl. That's Yulia, a local resident who also had to flee Kherson due to Russian shelling. She says her kids were again terrified and couldn't sleep. A hotel, several multi-story apartment blocks, a cultural facility, a bank, a post office, and several shops were damaged in the attack. And here's a look at some other stories we're following from around the world. White House National Security Spokesperson John Kirby said President Joe Biden is deeply concerned about the unauthorized release of classified documents on Israel's preparations for a potential retaliatory attack against Iran. Kirby said the administration still isn't certain if the classified information was leaked or hacked, and that the Pentagon is investigating. An initial toxicology report for the former One Direction singer Liam Payne, who died last week after falling from a third-floor hotel balcony in Buenos Aires, showed that he had cocaine in his system, an Argentine official said. However, the final toxicology results are not expected to be made public for some weeks. New York neighbors who went on to become cross-country rivals, the New York Yankees and Los Angeles Dodgers, are renewing their rivalry in the World Series for the first time in 43 years. They've met each other in the World Series 11 times before. It's the most frequent of any World Series matchup. Incidentally, the Yankees have won 8 of the 11 Yankees-Dodgers series. However, the Dodgers have a better record this year. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Botswana's election is off to a rocky start. That story coming up. Now, though, it's our daily look at the upcoming U.S. presidential election. Across the country, about 14 million voters are members of labor unions. And even as union members make up a small part of the American electorate, presidential candidates eagerly seek their endorsement. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson reports from Nevada, where unions have a powerful voice in this year's presidential election.
At a rally for Vice President Kamala Harris, excitement among union workers for her plan to end taxes on tips or gratuities that workers receive. Tani Castrol is a union representative for casino workers.
I know that Vice President Kamala Harris has a plan, a clear plan to end federal taxes on tips for us service workers here in Nevada. That's right. and that Donald Trump, pretending he is the tipped worker's savior, is a dangerous lie.
Former president and Republican candidate Donald Trump has also visited the city that relies on the service industry to promote his plan of no taxes on tips for casino dealers, waitresses, and housekeepers. Dee Dee Lima is a Trump supporter.
That is going to be adored by the employees, by all of the employees, particularly that don't have salaries and that they work on tips. That's going to be loved by them.
Trump has also earned the support of the Las Vegas Police Department. Steve Gromis is the president of the Las Vegas Protective Police Association.
The majority of our citizens trust law enforcement. And so if law enforcement says, hey, we believe this person has our best interests at heart, that they're going to keep you safe, that they're going to try and make our economy thrive, that people trust what we say.
Gromis has spoken about Trump's support for law enforcement at numerous rallies.
A man like Donald Trump and his campaign has always stood by us and said, no, I'm not going to bend to the winds of politics.
The endorsement of the tens of thousands of union workers employed in Nevada is eagerly sought by presidential candidates. Vice President Harris also earned the endorsement of the local Teamsters Union, but the National Organization of Freight Drivers and Warehouse Workers declined to endorse either presidential candidate. Some voters here in Nevada see that as an important sign.
Well, they always went Democratic. So now if they're not doing Democratic, that means they must be leaning towards who? Trump.
But the Culinary Workers Union in Las Vegas did endorse Harris. Ted Papageorge is the group's secretary treasurer.
Working class voters are smart. They're not dumb, and they are a little skeptical. But the problem with President Trump is that he lies, and he lies a lot. However, Vice President Harris, this is part of an overall program to tackle the cost of living.
And they're knocking on doors to let voters know.
We're just canvassing for Kamala Harris.
Okay.
Okay.
We're all voting for her.
Claudia Monreal is a member of the Culinary Workers Union.
Big corporations coming in and price gouging us on food, gas, you know, rent. So having, you know, the right candidate in office, you know, telling them the correct information, what I know as facts, that, you know, Kamala's going to be there for us, the middle class, the union members.
Union members here in Nevada, one of just a handful of swing states that decide the presidential election, could end up casting the deciding vote. Catherine Gibson in Las Vegas, Nevada, VOA News.
The southeastern Europe country of Moldova has just had a presidential election, as well as a referendum on taking steps towards joining the European Union. But as Sean Hogan of Reuters reports, election day was not without its problems.
A slim majority of just over 50% voted yes in a crunch referendum on European Union accession, after President Maia Sandu said Sunday's twin votes were marred by unprecedented alleged Russian-backed outside interference. The EU has also leapt to the leader's defence, claiming Russia and its proxies had meddled in the election. President of the European Commission Ursula von der Leyen hailed the outcome, quote, in the face of Russia's hybrid tactics, in a post on X. Sandu told media an outside attempt to buy votes amounted to an attack on the ex-Soviet Republic's sovereignty.
Their target of buying 300,000 votes documented by state institutions and paying 150,000 people to vote shows we must look closely at where mistakes were made and learn from this miserable attack on our sovereignty.
Atac mizerabil asupra suveranității noastre. Din păcate, sistemul de justiție...
Unfortunately, the justice system did not manage to do enough to prevent theft and vote corruption.
Și coruperea voturilor.
And here we will have to draw the line to correct what we did wrong and learn our lesson.
She said Moldova would respond with firm decisions. In the run-up to the vote, authorities made repeated statements alleging Moscow-backed attempts to meddle in the vote by fugitive tycoon Ilan Shor, who lives in Russia. Shor denies wrongdoing. The Kremlin denounces the vote, alleging there was a hard-to-explain increase in yes votes, and challenged Sandu to present evidence of meddling by Russia. The vote was seen as a test of the nation's aspirations to join the EU by 2030 and escape Moscow's orbit for good. In the run-up to Sunday's referendum, polls had shown clear majority support for joining the EU. A yes result means a clause will be added to the constitution defining EU accession as a goal. But the knife-edge finish is a dent in the pro-EU path pursued over 4 years. Sandu won 42% of the vote at a presidential election held simultaneously, while her main rival won 26%, a stronger result than polls had predicted, that now forces an early November runoff. As a champion of EU integration, the tight referendum result could put Sandu in a weaker position going into the second round. The future of the Southeast European nation has been in the spotlight since Russia's invasion of neighbouring Ukraine. Ties with Moscow have deteriorated as Sandu condemned the invasion and diversified energy supplies away from Russia.
Reuters' Sean Hogan reporting for us. And a contentious election in Botswana as well. That's where early voting was marred by irregularities, including a lack of paper ballots, forcing the electoral body to order a rerun in some voting areas. The Independent Electoral Commission, or IEC, has been criticized for mishandling the voting process as concerns mount ahead of the general election set for October 30th. From Habone, Mikandosi Dube reports, this story narrated for us by Scott Walterman.
Advance voting was open to more than 12,000 polling officers and thousands of police officers and army personnel. Jefferson Siame Song, secretary of the IEC, says his office didn't anticipate the large turnout and they ran out of ballots. Also, in some of the 61 constituencies, he says there were irregularities with the ballots and the voter rolls, so in those areas, they will have a makeup election this weekend. He's saying that they apologize to the voters and plead with them to go vote again on Saturday in the areas affected by the irregularities. He said they'll be better prepared to make sure everyone gets a chance to vote. The conduct of the advance voting by the IEC has attracted criticism from political parties, including the ruling Botswana Democratic Party, or BDP. BDP spokesperson Kelalo Kantisi says the IEC must address the situation to ensure that voters get the right to vote. Opposition Botswana Congress Party BCP President Dumelang Charle Shendo says his party is considering legal action against the electoral body. He's saying we're very concerned with what happened today. It's clear that the IEC was not prepared to conduct the elections. He says they don't want the IEC to deny citizens the right to vote on October 30th just because they're not ready. Opposition Coalition Umbrella for Democratic Change said it was evident that there are efforts to rig the election. The UDC will lead other opposition parties in a protest scheduled for Saturday. Political analyst Adam Pepe says public perception of the IEC has been eroded following these events. He says the situation will help advance claims from opposition parties that the poll will be rigged. For Botswana voters abroad, 10 out of 51 polling stations also ran out of ballots. The IEC says those affected will also be allowed to vote this Saturday. From Mdisi Dube in Botswana, I'm Scott Walterman, VOA News.
And that's going to wrap it up for us today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Steve Karish.
We'll be right back.